Hello, my name is Craig, and you're listening to Mental Health Insights. Today with me is Nicole, Kristen, and Pete. Pete, this is your first time on our podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to join the party.
Yeah, so today, Pete's actually joining us today because of the topic that we're having. We are going to start to dive into the world and increase our understanding of trauma. And I know that this is one of Nicole's favorite topics specifically. She's been wanting to talk about this for a while. You said that we need to try to keep you in check, but I think that's okay because this is what people want to know, right? So the first things first, and I know that all of you guys may have different orientations just like I do, and that's what's wonderful about therapy. I want you guys just kind of tell me in your own definition or your own type of viewpoint, what is trauma? And any one of you guys can go first, or it would be easier if I go first.
I'm happy to go first.
All right, go ahead.
I like to think of trauma isn't just what happens during an event. It's also what happens after. Because if you think of the stress response cycle, if it has a chance to complete in some fashion, in other words, if there's support that allows the person to actually complete the stress response cycle, then it often doesn't get locked in as trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma happens all the time to us during life, car crash, significant events or whatever. If we're able to move through it, then it doesn't necessarily become trauma in and of itself that gets stuck. So it's not just what happens, but what happens after that's really important.
Okay. So for you, what you're saying, trauma is what ends up happening that may get us stuck, or it's what happens after an incident happens, and mm-hmm. it kind of sticks with you after that.
Absolutely.
All right.
I love that, Pete, and what I think of it as an imprint in the body and in the brain map. Mm-hmm. So when I'm thinking about a traumatic event, you know, we work with clients, Pete and I do trauma work. So let's do trauma level one would be a succinct event like the car accident or something like that, where a complex trauma might be ongoing or perpetual, like for young children. Father might be an alcoholic.
Can you talk to me about the differences between those two types of trauma that you just named?
Absolutely. So a one-time trauma is not imprinted in the brain and body where it has the long-lasting effects that Pete's talking about. It kind of finishes that cycle a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And as far as therapeutically, it's easier to treat a succinct trauma because either they have had a baseline before that, like if with a car accident you had a normal baseline of, remember when we talk about sympathetic versus parasympathetic,
yeah.
It kind of keeps it calm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where complex trauma is perpetual, so it stays in that person's body when they're developing. So like what Pete's talking about, we'll get into a little bit later, is more about the hyperreactivity, the hypervigilance. You know, it starts affecting multiple systems in the body. You're scanning for stress and trauma when you have complex trauma. Some of that happens with succinct, but it's not as strong as it is with complex. It doesn't affect the development of the person as much.
Okay. A couple minutes in, and we are already discovering that there's a couple different types of trauma. So for you, kind of your definition of trauma, it looks pretty similar to Pete's. You said it's almost like this imprint that ends up happening. It's affecting the brain. And you'd say the brain and the body, is that what you said?
Absolutely.
Okay. Imprint. I like that word. How are you, Kristen?
Yeah, as I hear them talking about trauma, the word that sticks out to me is the word being stuck. And I notice many of my clients that have been traumatized are stuck in the feelings that they had when they experienced the trauma. And that is a hallmark in my eyes.
All right. I think that maybe I agree with all your guys' definitions. I think I just have a little bit different view on it. Whenever I think of trauma, or I'm thinking of defining trauma, I actually think of it as it's a way that someone survives. So whenever someone has trauma or they develop trauma, and whenever I'm thinking of, okay, what's going on with this person, they survive some type of event, and their trauma that happened to them was a degree in which their brain and their body had to adapt, had to go into a certain state in order to keep them alive.
That's a great aspect to talk about. It is.
That's why I went last, so that.
Yeah, it's a survival instinct in your brain, so that you can remember. and not have that happen again.
Yeah, so we can all take a moment. Thank you, brain, for keeping us safe and keeping us alive. So like from here, I want to kind of talk a little bit about just what Nicole was actually getting into. There's different types of trauma. And I was hoping that you guys can kind of just talk to me a little bit about some of those different types of trauma. So we have the succinct and we have the complex trauma. I know there's a lot of different names out there for these different types. And I just kind of want you guys to tell me about your experience and some of the different types of trauma that you've seen and worked with.
I work a lot with developmental trauma. Mm-hmm. Many people contact me because they have anxiety, and they come to me, and I get a very in-depth history from them. And typically, there's parents getting divorced, some sort of sexual abuse, neglect, something in their history that has affected their development and has resulted in anxiety and depression that they suffer from today.
Can you tell me just a little bit about what might make developmental trauma look or feel just a little bit different than, let's say, you know, I'm a 30-year-old and something traumatic happens to me right there?
Well, like Nicole was saying, there's a difference between succinct trauma and a trauma that happens over and over and over again. As trauma happens over and over and over again, your brain sort of develops around that. The image that's coming to my mind is like if you put like a stick in a developing tree and the tree kind of grows around that stick or something and just keeps on going. That's the image that I have with developmental trauma. But whereas a trauma just that happens in your 30s, like a car accident or a divorce or something like that, your tree or your brain is already developed. So that trauma with the tree analogy would look like sawing off a limb or something.
Okay. I really like that metaphor. That you used, by the way. I don't know why. Whenever you said that, I was actually picturing like a tree growing, and then you used it. I was like, oh my gosh.
You guys are insane.
That's exactly, that's exactly what I was thinking about. How about for both of you two? What are some types of trauma?
Yeah, I think what she was saying about developmental is so critical, because what we've learned in the last 20 plus years or so with regard to neuroscience is how at the various stages of brain development, even in utero, that is trauma happens, even happening to the mother, it can get transferred down to the child. And then as a child is growing up, these various events that happen, whether they're small, a little bullying on the playground, or a divorce, or something more significant, like a significant loss, these things build up. But when they occur, similar to what I said earlier, is a child given the coping skills to navigate through them or not? Mm-hmm. And then if not, then the brain doesn't continue developing in a healthy fashion. There are parts of the brain that get stunted or get wired in a particular way that then orients them to the stress response that makes them more easily startled, anxious, afraid, mm-hmm. or more angry and aggressive, or even depressed, depending on how that child has learned to adapt, as you were saying earlier, adapt that adaptive part of the stress response.
I think what's interesting, I don't know why I thought about this whenever you said this, but two things. Whenever I was just reading an article the other day, and spiders that are around cities that get hit by hurricanes frequently develop more aggressive species of spiders. And while, like for us, we're humans, really complex, other types of animals can experience similar type of interactions or passing down certain traits. And trauma is something that is so interesting, the way that we can now see that it is traveling throughout different generations and mm-hmm. how it's really affecting vast amounts of population. There's also another comment that I want to make. You said like big and little as you're using to describe something. And I just kind of want to say for some of our listeners, like whenever we use those words, we're using those words to kind of try to distinguish between things. If you got into a car accident, it could have been a big deal for you, right? It could have been a huge thing. And if we say like, oh, like something little may happen, we're not trying to say that a car accident is little in your thing. people can experience similar things that happen and it impact them such a vastly different. So for us, we just have to use it as a descriptor so that we can try to distinguish between those two intensities. I don't know why, whenever you're talking about
that, thank you for that description, because I think it can be minimizing for people. And as I was saying earlier too, part of that, whether it's big or little, can have a lot to do with developmentally. Mm-hmm. If they experienced some traumas when they were younger, what might be little for some might be really big for someone else, because they're already oriented to that stress response hyperactively or hypervigilantly. Mm-hmm. And so it has a bigger impact on that person, even if it's not a very big event, so to speak.
Yeah,
and we call it little T and big T just for that purpose. Not mm-hmm. that it's not a big event, but for, you know, if you had 10 people that were raped, only two are going to develop PTSD. The rest are not going to see that as a big T for them in that particular moment mm-hmm. in their life or in their development. They have the resources to come back from that. Mm-hmm. And if I could just go back to what Pete was talking about, neuroscience, we're talking about the amygdala, and that's in the middle of the brain, in that limbic system that we've discussed mm-hmm. before. That's really an important component of trauma. When we think about the amygdala is taking in all five senses along with intention, which is very important. Pete and I did an exercise from somatic experiencing this past week, and I've done a great deal of work, and it was very interesting to me as he walked towards my body. We're facing one another. I could feel my vagus nerve down into my chest mm-hmm. and into my stomach. So remember, we talked about the vagus nerve is that 10th cranial nerve, and you can kind of feel it down your throat. You can get choked up into your chest, that tightening, and then all the way down into the gut, like someone punches you into the mesenteric part of the bowel. So all of that's kind of hypervigilant. That's connected to the amygdala and trauma. And so that's what becomes dysregulated in people that have that. So even if you have good vagal tone and good regulation, people can have these triggers. So as he was walking towards me, I noticed black shoes that he was wearing that particular day. As he came out of the peripherals were particularly difficult, and that reminded me of my father when he was in the military. And so I was about 5 or 6 years old, and my body was right back in that moment, not as an mm-hmm. adult person, and it wasn't terribly terrifying. I just remember it being a loud sound and that color and that vibration of feeling. So I was back in that moment. So that's what's important about trauma or a flashback. It's taking you back in time in those sensations and feelings that you're talking about, Kristen, and it's really not just this visual, but this all-encompassing, mm-hmm. the body remembers, it has no sense of time in the now.
So would you refer to an experience like that as developmental trauma?
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. So I think that's something that's important, is like whenever we're distinguishing between developmental trauma and maybe even just... I don't know, for some reason in my mind, I didn't know it was called succinct. I'd always call it like static, like it's just like a one-time event that happens. But static is really a poor word for it because it kind of continues
afterwards.
I love
the word succinct. Sounds great.
Short and to the point. Yes.
So whenever it sounds like, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, that most people that are walking around with trauma, it is developmental.
Yeah, I would say 95% of my clients have developmental trauma, and it's evident in their interpersonal relationships, their hypervigilance, mm-hmm. when we think of symptoms, and their amygdala scanning. So if, like Pete talked about, if you've had this happen so many times in your life, now your brain's looking for it without your permission or awareness. It's at a subconscious level, and you're anticipating danger from a dog or someone coming from the side or things like this. It starts building up in your life. So that's a huge part of it for sure.
As you guys are talking about this, awareness is like screaming out in my brain. Like one of the first pieces of therapy is developing an awareness of your trauma. And like mm-hmm. I said, most people seek me out for anxiety. They don't know that they have had trauma. They mm-hmm. don't connect it. They mm-hmm. say to me, why are we talking about my past? It's over. It's done. But they don't understand the nature of trauma, and that, like, as you said, you were that little girl again. Mm-hmm. That is the nature of trauma. You are back in those feelings, even though presently you are safe and secure and nothing's going to happen to you. So the example that I use for these clients to sort of explain this concept is adopting a dog from a shelter. So if you have small children in your house and you go to adopt a dog from a shelter, hopefully one of the first questions you ask is, what is this animal's history? Because that's going to help you know if they have aggression or fear, if it's not, if you can't tell right then and there. And humans are no different. So if a dog can have scars from its mm-hmm. upbringing, being tied down to a concrete slab, a human can obviously have scars as well. We're much more complex emotionally. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think fear is the imprint that's left in the body in those particular organs or in that moment in time. So I love that you said that with fear. I think most people that have developmental trauma are in terrified bodies, or they're terrorized in some way, in some aspect of their self. And so that's where the disassociation starts to happen when a person isn't able to leave. Like an adult in a car crash, they can get up and recover from that. But a child may have to stay in that environment. So to be able to do that, they can't physically leave. They can't emotionally leave. So psychologically, they disengage from the body. And so that's a really good coping mechanism in that moment. But we have to teach our clients to kind of come out of that, just like you have to retrain the dog's behavior.
Yeah, and it's possible. It is possible. It's possible to rewire and retrain your brain. And it's not perfect, and you won't forget, but you can feel better.
Just like you're saying, the tree can still grow, even though there's something that may be blocking it initially.
Yeah, it'll just grow in a different direction. But it's still growing up and into the sun.
And it makes it unique. That's what's beautiful about the tree.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's something that I want to ask you guys to elaborate on. I think we've actually talked about this before, but I think that it bears us mentioning and bringing up again. Can you guys talk to me about hypervigilance? Whenever you see someone that is hypervigilance, what is happening to them? What are you kind of, as an outsider, noticing?
Can I talk about my hypervigilance?
Sure.
Go ahead.
I talk about my husband quite frequently. I think he should be a therapist. He won't. But my hypervigilance, because of my developmental trauma in the past, is equated to following my husband around the house obsessively, saying hi, asking him if he's okay, just paying attention to his facial expressions very intently, and being very sensitive to any sort of change in the environment. Because basically what I had been watching out for is, am I okay? Am I safe in this relationship? Am I loved? And all of those things. Am I safe? Am I safe? Mm-hmm. And so that's what hypervigilance had looked like for me until I went through EMDR therapy. And so it still creeps up a little bit, but that's my example.
I love that you said that, because what I'm hearing is that amygdala has been conditioned to that. And so while your conscious mind is quite aware your husband's there and it's fine, the subconscious part of your brain is still reacting. And let's remember, the myelination, or the wiring to that vagus nerve through the amygdala, is much faster. It's like a fast highway. It's like being on the Autobahn compared to being on Highway 70.
I think it's something like 10,000 to 100,000 times faster.
Yeah. It's very quick. So it's going to the amygdala into the body much quicker, even though consciously you're like, my husband's right there, I know it's fine, but something else is wired and it's going to keep you alive. So when we're in downstairs brain, we're going to be very reactive in that. And so that's a beautiful, I hope we'll get to talk next session about EMDR and how that works and integrates that into the brain so that you can process it.
When you were talking about whether I'm safe or not, what I was thinking of is just the idea with developmental trauma, how our attachment gets broken. Healthy attachment gets broken with our caregivers, which affects the vagus nerve. And that part, you guys talked about polyvagal last time, if I remember correctly. And so part of that polyvagal going back into parasympathetic is also the social engagement system, which says, I'm safe, I'm okay, everything's fine. It allows us to shift back into that space. And when that doesn't happen developmentally, it does get conditioned into us, and we are constantly, even though intellectually we may know that the environment is safe or this person is safe, our body is telling us something very, very different, and that story is trickling up from the body up, and there's that battle going on. And that's where, you know, the polyvagal theory really helped to explain this idea where we have one thing going on here and another thing going on here, and we're trying to shift our entire being back into that safe space.
All of this is about survival. That social survival instinct is because we're pack animals.
Yes.
And especially as children, we're the most vulnerable of all of the animals. Am I correct? We have to have our people accept us and love us, because that equates to food, shelter, and water.
Yeah, I tell clients that if they're familiar with Maslow, I think Maslow missed that one, because Maslow talked about the hierarchy of needs, and he had, you know, social and emotional, whatever, as the second level. But what we've discovered is that actually that love and acceptance, yeah, attachment is at the base level. If we don't get it, not only is our brain not developed, we develop health issues. We have all kinds of problems, and it doesn't allow us to actually thrive in the world the way we need to. People literally can die from loneliness.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's like you have, like that might even be able to be called a different type of trauma, attachment-related trauma. And one of the things that I know that for me while I'm hearing you guys, whenever I think of someone developing hypervigilance, I don't know why I think about this. Have you guys ever been to Chuck E. Cheese? So here in the Midwest, Chuck E. Cheese is a place where you go with kids, a terrible pizza and everything, but you play these different games, you get tickets.
Where a kid can be a kid.
Yeah, so there's a great game called the Jackpot, and it's just real simple. The light just goes around, and you have to try to press the button right as it hits the jackpot thing.
That's my game, brother.
As I'm sitting here thinking of hypervigilance, it's like I am waiting for this to, waiting for the light to turn on there. And whenever I miss it, I'm like, okay, I'm going to wait again. Like, you're just focused so intently on waiting for this one cue, that light to show up. Mm-hmm. And when you feel like, all right, you know, it's going really fast, I'm going to try to hit this a little bit ahead of time, right? Or I just missed it or anything. So you are focusing so intently. Sometimes you press too soon. Sometimes you press too late. All of your attention, effort, or focus on this. And that's like what hypervigilance is, where you are at your peak attention, focused on these different cues that the amygdala is governing, being like, hey, watch out for this. Be careful with this. And while you're in that state of hypervigilance, you're so focused, you actually cannot feel safe because you're waiting for a cue that may not ever come.
We're killing the analogies today.
Mm-hmm. And as we're thinking about it, I'm thinking of a cheetah getting ready to pounce on a prey. That's kind of what it feels like. You know, it's that same kind of feeling.
Anticipatory feeling.
Yeah, or anticipatory anxiety.
Or if you sense a cheetah's in the neighborhood, and then there's that, the stiffening.
The fear.
Yeah, the stiffening up, and then the looking around, the visual acuity narrows because you're trying to figure out, where's it coming from? Where is it? I hear
and
something.
And sound. Yeah. I love that you said that, Pete, and sound. Talk about the inner ear a little bit with the polyvagal, too.
Oh, yeah. So we attune ourselves to voice and sounds in the threat response. And it actually cues in on lower frequencies. In safe mode, we're actually cued into the voice, the actual frequencies that the voice ranges in, because it's how we know that somebody actually is safe rather than being a threat.
Right. And male tones are really difficult for a lot of my females.
Yes,
so
they
just
are,
because the vocal cords are wider, so it's deeper, so that can be a triggering sound. And people that are hypervigilant, like dogs, you know, they hear 10 times or 100 times what we hear. They're picking up on it. People with PTSD or the advanced or complex traumas are able to hone in on sounds that are far away, very subtle sounds that most people don't recognize. So the sound is huge, smell is huge. When we go back to the senses, and different tactile cues. All five senses are taken in when you're thinking about this. So I don't know if you guys have any analogies for some of those that trigger that hypervigilance and that.
Well, this is just kind of how I'm thinking about it. It's kind of like a beautiful chaos that ends up showing up for someone whenever they end up having PTSD. They're having relationship issues. Their PTSD is specifically geared to really make it hard for them in relationships, because as things start to get more and more intense with you and your significant other, and their voice starts to alter, it's more likely to hit some of those tones.
Right.
Because it is altering, it's going to hit some of those tones, which is going to set you off. You're already in a hypervigilant state because you're sitting there at the jackpot machine waiting for the cue, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody pushes you away from the machine. You're like, no, we got to stay at the machine because I got to press the button. It's kind of a setup for disaster, really, a lot of times.
That early attachment is really difficult. It really shows up in interpersonal relationships.
And people don't know.
Right.
I think most of the population doesn't know, and then they end up blaming the relationship issues on things that
aren't the root cause.
The root of everything is my passion. I was thinking, as you guys were talking to that, gestures, like body gestures, can be very triggering. We have my therapy dog Piper in here right now, and she's a border collie, and border collies are very sensitive to gestures as well. So if I tell her to sit and I'm standing a certain way, she may or may not listen to me because she associates certain body language with certain commands too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because not only are we looking and listening, but we're picking up on the nonverbals, and that actually is more important. I mean, the primary form of communication is the nonverbals, and that's all part of our stress responses. We're actually looking for all those nonverbals.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just thinking 90% is nonverbal communication, as he said that.
Oh, absolutely.
As we're all looking at each other and watching each other's body language.
And we're reading all of that stuff without even realizing and feeling it in our body.
Yeah, so we're talking about this stuff. I'm thinking, you know, about this question, how does trauma impact our stress response? And I'm thinking about how clients come to us, and that many of them say, oh, I just want to develop some coping skills. I'm like, oh, honey, okay. So we can come up with some coping skills to manage your stress response, certainly, but it goes a lot deeper than that. So instead of just managing the stress response, why don't we make it go away or greatly reduce it? And then you'll be really top-notch.
It's like having a mold problem in your house and you decide to slap a coat of paint over it instead.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So we're here to educate and help clients.
Just made that up.
Yeah, that was perfect.
You can have it.
Yeah, so just know, you know, if you're seeking out a therapist, you're probably going to be going a lot deeper than you ever imagined.
Which actually won't be... it won't be as hard as you may think that it is a lot of times. So whenever people get frustrated with coping skills, it's a catch-22 word because everybody thinks that that's what they need. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about, like, how does trauma impact our stress response, as we're talking about with, like, hypervigilance and everything, it just kind of cranks it into overdrive. It's there all the time. And your amygdala is on high alert for these signals that things are going to be really dangerous or you're in danger, and it's trying to keep you safe. So your body's amping up to try to keep you safe. So the stress response is really actually being used very, very consistently. And it's being used so consistently that it's kind of running you dry.
Absolutely.
And the difficulty with that is it becomes a, you know, becomes positive reinforcement again and again. Because if your stress response is only meant to be just like a quick thing, right? It's only meant to give you a quick dump of resources so you could survive whatever the threat is. But if I am, you know, I'm triggered by a certain sound or anything like that because of, you know, I got into a car accident years ago and like certain sounds, they really set me off. Then all of a sudden I hear things in that spectrum all the time. You know, if I work in a factory or, you know, or I'm around certain noises, I'm in a busy restaurant or anything, and I'm constantly getting hit by that. Like, all of a sudden, my amygdala is like, oh, my gosh, we got to be ready all the time. This could happen at any moment, and you could be in that same danger. So then we end up getting amped up all the time, and we don't have enough resources or really enough capability to calm ourselves down and to actually form an idea of what it even looks like to be safe. And instead, our new normal becomes everyone's a threat. Everything around me is a threat. And this is okay, right? The house is on fire, but it's okay because I like the heat kind of thing.
Well, I love what you said, Craig, because when I'm thinking of hypervigilance, it goes even deeper than that. So let's connect back to the hypothalamus, you know, that relays with the hippocampus for memory and our that conditioned response you're talking about, and the amygdala. And that's now affecting people with PTSD or complex trauma in their sleep, their sex drive, and their food. Mm-hmm. So now we are dysregulated in every area of this person's life where they're coming in. I need coping skills, and I don't sleep more than 5 hours a night, and I've been this way for 10 years, 20 years. This is the complex trauma that has not been treated. So it takes a long time to treat that, but it's very possible to treat that. Okay, there's a lot of different, I know next time we'll talk about some of the interventions or maybe touch on that a little bit today, but getting into these sleep hygiene, you know, kind of coming at this from multiple angles, looking at the all-encompassing balance of a person's life and what they've been conditioned to learn in their life to even have trauma, right? Learning to come at that.
Sleep hygiene is such a big deal.
Yeah,
it hits the HPA axis.
That's right.
Which really, really, when the hormones get thrown way out of whack, it creates all kinds of health issues, adrenal fatigue, you know, chronic stomach issues, the gut. You know, a lot of things like that that really start to stack up. And so, yeah, hitting it from multiple angles. So, you know, like you were saying, just coping skills, yeah, okay, that's okay. But let's see if we can get to the root of some of these things and what's causing it.
Gaber Mate has some amazing content out on YouTube about all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Totally floored.
So this is kind of what I'm thinking. I just actually want to walk through. Let's do like kind of like a make-believe story kind of thing, right? So let's say a child's growing up, and as they're growing up, they experience some bullying in school. So they get this preconception or this notion that other people don't really like me, or that I can't really do things right. And as they get older, you know, maybe they start doing poorly in school because these kids that bully them, they're at school. They start doing poorly at school, grades start getting bad, parents start getting on them, keep on getting this message. I can't do this right, people don't like me, they don't even think I'm smart, right? So they start to develop this narrative of themselves, but not only that, their brain is responding to that narrative. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden while they're at school, it's harder for them to pay attention, it's harder for them to feel safe at school. So their anxiety, you know, their stress response may actually be already activating at school, and as it's continually activated, it's starting some of this developmental trauma that we're talking about, which then primes them actually to have more traumatic experiences. Mom and dad have a huge fight and they end up throwing something at each other, hits the child, you know, they may be 12 years old. All of a sudden it's like, mom and dad hate me, right? And it just starts to continue to exacerbate because now the amygdala is starting to look for more cues. It's noticing more things. And as it's noticing more things, you're staying in the stress response longer. As you're staying in the stress response longer, your own internal narrative of your life starts to become more sinister. Not only does everybody like me, people will hurt me. People can't be safe. I can't trust mom and dad to keep me safe. When people argue, like, it's normal to argue in marriage. It's normal to argue in relationships. They have this twisted and sinister view of things, and then their own internal view of themselves starts to get shifted so much. And that's with us just talking about how it starts with just bullying. It doesn't include all the other developmental traumas that may occur or may come to us. So just to kind of give you an idea of how this can compound so quickly, right? Then you have someone who has difficulty in school. This continues throughout their lifetime at school because their brain has associated school as not a safe place, so they're hypervigilant in it, which makes it harder for them to learn, harder to pay attention, harder for their brain to store the information that they're learning in it for long-term, you know, learning. It's harder for them to take tests, so they get labeled as ADHD. They get different medications for it. They become depressed because it's hard for them to develop friends because their anxiety. Their stress response is going off. People aren't safe, so they aren't talking to people. So now they get something for, depression or anxiety-related things. And they're continually compounding some of the challenges that they're going through that all started out at such a young age. And it all started out with maybe something that could have been, you know, could have been intervened with right away. But the stress response, responding to a threat, made it easier for them to survive that situation. But since they're continually being introduced to that situation, it creates that trauma. It creates a permanent change. That permanent change continues to be exacerbated. So I don't know. For me, like, I'm like, hey, right, yeah. I want to kind of look at like a longer term thing. So
the part that really stood out, I love that analogy, and that really summarizes kind of all the things that we're saying. But I think what's important when you think of that child that's 12 and my dad doesn't like me because he got hit, I think that's important. What happens internally in a child before they have critical thinking? I am that, whatever happened to me, not that's an event that happened to me. And so that's one of the first things that we start to look at when we're looking at that narrative in trauma therapy. So a lot of times people have internalized that. It's very hard to separate and take in positive for us people that have those challenges.
Definitely, definitely.
I was wondering what you guys think about medicine on this subject.
I think medicine definitely has its place. I think a lot of people kind of pull the trigger pretty quick for it. And I understand that we live in a society that promotes medication pretty strongly.
Yeah. Before anything else, it's like, oh, you're sad, here's some medicine.
Oh, yeah. I think that I worked a lot with adolescents. I think you probably get about like 50 to 70% of them that get prescribed something. Yeah. And if they're prescribed something, it's usually going to be something for ADHD. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, if that's the case, but we know from different research done on different populations that that many kids don't actually have ADHD. Right. So you're like, all right, well, that means how many kids or how many people are taking medication that or they don't actually need to. But this is actually the worst side of it. How many of those people that actually need the medication will stop taking it because they think they're someone that doesn't? So it's this double-edged sword where you don't want to have someone that, you know, has depression and they're thinking that, like, I'm going to be okay without this medication when that's really actually not going to be the truth. Mm-hmm. Whereas you may have someone else that does have depression and they're taking medication and it's not really quite depression that's going on for them. There is other types of things that are going on, and depression is actually part of that, but it's not the main thing. And all of a sudden they're having other issues because of that medication that they're taking. I think that's really easy for things to get exacerbated with medications. But at the same time, it's a hard balance because there are some people that really, truly benefit from being on medications.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what I typically do, because this will often come up if I have a client who isn't on medication yet and they're coming with strong symptoms. And basically, as the conversation I have with them is, so how are you functioning? And are you in a place where you can still hold down a job and you can, you know, maintain your family or whatever it is that you're trying to do to live your life? If you reach a point where that becomes more difficult, I can understand where medication might be a good intervention for you potentially. But I also talk about looking at holistic things, diet, exercise, some of these other things that can have a significant impact on mood and maybe even shift them in a way where medication may not be necessary. Yeah. Or if they're on medication, they may be able to start tapering it down. And I encourage them to get with a psychiatrist in particular who actually has a broader view of that if they're with one. Yeah, for that reason, because some psychiatrists I've worked with actually believe in therapy plus medication as opposed to just medication and then send them on their way. Right.
Awesome. I think that's hard too, because if someone, like, so we have a trauma client that comes in, and we'd say about 99% of them have sleep issues. It'd be really strange if they didn't. And coming in with sleep issues, so if you're talking about just like we're going to give any type of medication, you could pump them with as much depression or anti-anxiety and depression medication as you want. If they are only sleeping a couple hours a night, there is not going to be any possibility of normal functioning. You might hit the marks most of the time, but your ability to control your emotions or anything is just out the window with that. And I think that's one of the reasons that this is so hard. We as the medical community, it's really hard to see a person not only holistically, but it's really hard to see, we want people to get better really quick, but things don't happen very quick with trauma. There's mm-hmm. a reason that it doesn't, mm-hmm. because the stress response is trying to keep you alive. You're trying to convince your body and your brain that it's okay, you don't have to be, but that's a really hard thing to convince, right? You're trying to, it's like someone's pointing a gun at you, and you're trying to tell yourself that they're not going to shoot, even though they're giving you all the signs that they are.
Right.
It's really difficult.
Something that many people experience is like, I'm going through this therapy, I'm doing this work, but I can't trust. I don't know what to trust in my head anymore. Like, mm-hmm. am I in danger? Am I not? I don't know.
It's a new normal. And if I could just step one step back when we're talking about medication, I love one piece of some of the SSRIs. The benefit of some of those is that it marinates those neurons to allow us to do interventions that would be more effective mm-hmm. to turn off that response.
Absolutely.
I love the word marinate.
Oh, sorry.
I think that's so awesome.
I think of it like that.
Yeah.
The neurobiology, like the
absolutely.
Chemical compound
it kicks
that kind of solidifies it.
Yeah.
Kind of mm-hmm.
It gets you in a different
together.
Direction.
Yeah, and I think that's important. And to keep in mind, these integrative medicines, and I come at an approach from everything. I do a lot of holistic things like Pete does. I've used medication, Western medicine, mm-hmm. cupping, you know, we do lots of different things like that. But I think it's really important to know you can fire and wire without medication as well. Mm-hmm. So it really is a case-by-case basis. And I love working with, you know, psychiatrists that are not over-medicating, because a lot of times with developmental trauma, it can really look like bipolar or some of these other conditions where we have high highs and low lows. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pendulation between dysregulation. And so I want to be very careful to work with a psychiatrist, not a regular medical doctor, when we're talking about that, to really look at this case a little more clearly.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things you said there, too, that I think that is that's important, is that if we're thinking about seeing a regular doctor and getting, you know, your primary care and getting different types of medications, it's hard because they don't have the same type of training. But it's also hard as a psychiatrist. I mean, they're trying to treat something, they don't even get a picture of the brain, they don't get an MRI or anything. Like, we don't have we're not at that place where that can be common in any type, you know, every single office or anything. And it'll be really exciting once things are. Also, SSRIs are really low risk too.
Absolutely.
Except for some of the couples I work with, because it's hard for sex. But
right, the sexual side effects are huge, especially for men. A lot of my veterans are having difficulty with that. They don't want to use medication, and they've been over-medicated. You know, they put them on trazodone to go to sleep. They hop them up on Adderall to wake up all day. Then they're on SSRIs.
Yeah.
They're coming and going, and it's like they're already dysregulated in their circadian rhythm. What can we do to kind of, I love working with the psychiatrist in the treatment plan and having them on board, if we can all be more in a collaborative environment, to kind of look at what's the objective for this client? What does that look like to advocate for them and have them have a short and long-term plan for medication management, and then also the treatments that we're using and intervening? I think that's huge.
Yeah, so I kind of want to take a 30,000 foot view at this. So when we're talking about trauma, even the whole reason that we're having this conversation is because it's so expansive. I mean, you're talking about something that affects your diet, like how appealing different things are. It's affecting your ability to sleep, your ability to be close to people. It affects, it can even affect your body temperature, your blood pressure, affects your, there's another thing that I was right on the edge of my tongue, but the whole picture of this is it's affecting so many different areas of your being that it becomes hard because it's so invasive that a lot of people that have trauma, they think that this is just normal functioning, and it actually isn't. So having that multifaceted approach is just really important, just to wrap our heads around, like, this is a total war. Like, if you are wanting to combat trauma, it is a total war. It is not just one battle we're trying to win. It is everything in you that is being attacked by this. And it's hard because it's an internal battle that is happening. And the trauma, the only thing it is just the residual effect of your body and your brain surviving something that happened to you. And trying to get your body and brain to a place where it is okay for you to feel safe again. Right? Because PTSD is a wonderful example. Our brain is continually trying to return back to normal functioning. And a lot of that is what is happening with PTSD, is we have these traumatic events that are kind of off in our unconscious brain, and then something triggers them to come back to our conscious brain. And as it comes to our conscious brain, it's that opportunity to try to process it and try to reduce it. But the problem is, it's just so big. It's so massive, it becomes really hard to do.
One of the things that I think is helpful when I heard you kind of, you know, solidify and tie all that together, I think it's important, the internal experience and also the external experience. So that's very taxing to a body when you have all this internal stuff happening, and you have to regulate the external environment. Mm-hmm. So I hope next time we'll get to talk more about the ACE studies and some of the disease processes and interventions that we use in that. I think that would be really awesome to talk about.
Yeah, and I think that the way I kind of want to wrap this up is the possibility for our brain to heal, kind of even as Kristen said, closer to the beginning of this, is profound. There can be something that happens really early. You know, we're talking about that that stick that happens in the tree, or the way I was thinking of it is like a concrete that's placed over it and the tree still grows through it, kind of thing, just because Mother Nature is a beast like that. But the capability of the brain to adapt, to survive, to thrive is profound. And it's the same thing with trauma. is that even if there are portions of the brain that we didn't really talk about today, like different neural connections that will literally get severed to create these black spots in the brain of zero neural activity, the brain will wire around it and still continue to create different connections, different functionings, and very small amounts of brain functioning can be lost with that because the brain's ability to be so adaptive. So our brain's ability to heal is, if we get our arm chopped off, our arm isn't healing, but we can have like this hole that happens in our brain due to a traumatic experience, and our brain can wire around it.
That's why I'm thrilled with this work. You know, when I did drug and alcohol addiction, it's a 1-2% recovery. Mm-hmm. Trauma recovery, we can do 99.9% recovery. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting work.
I love my
job. It's a privilege. Yeah, it's a privilege to work in this field.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's an honor to work with people that have this human condition, mm-hmm. of overcoming, and that human spirit can overdo anything.
Well, everybody loves rooting for an underdog.
I know, right?
All right, and that's kind of really what this is.
I love the underdog.
Oh, yeah. So I thank you guys for coming in here today, talking with me about this. Really, us coming from this standpoint of simplifying trauma and talking about its different aspects is really important because it is so prevalent in our society. And I also look forward to our next conversation that we're going to have, and we'll hit some of those things that you're talking about, Nicole. We're talking about different assessment types. We're going to talk about different ways of managing, but more likely not necessarily managing because we don't want to get into the coping skill talk, more ways of being able to rewire our brain so the trauma is not as prevalent or it completely goes away. Which is a process. It's a step process, and I know that all of us have a little bit different ways of doing that, and that's what's so cool about it. Just like with human beings, there are so many different ways to help, and that's because we're all a little bit different, and that's just a miracle of this little world that we're on. So I want to thank you guys all for joining us and tuning in. I hope that you guys will listen to our next episode where it's a little more of the upswing, how to treat a lot of this. And we look forward to talking to you then. Thank you for listening to Mental Health Insights. We hope that you guys have a good one. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information. And those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. The music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.